tonight on Arena. Deirdre Kinahan and Steve Wickham on Deirdre's play Tempesta, and new albums from Bonnie Light Horseman, Eels and Landless up for review. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Tempesta is Deirdre Kinahan's play, with a score composed and performed live by Steve Wickham of the Waterboys. It's all part of Cork Midsummer, which starts next week. And Tempesta, the play, tells the tale of two Dubliners caught up in the onslaught of war in 1930s Europe and wondering if their love can survive it all. Delighted to be joined in studio this evening by Deirdre Kinahan and indeed Steve Wickham, who has brought his guitar in with him and will be proof of that what I tell you is ne'er a lie. And he will be performing more for us a little bit later on. This is, Deirdre, these are fictional characters, Ellie Rosen and Louis Doyle, but there is a basis in reality, or certainly an inspiration in reality, for the two characters.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, these two characters are inspired by two real people, Etty Steinberg and Charlie Donnelly. So I've always been really interested in that period in Irish history and the Spanish Civil War and the fact that young Irish men and women went over and fought in that war for an ideal.
That's what Charlie Donnelly did.
And very famously, he coined that phrase, "Even the olives are bleeding," which apparently is something he said just before he was shot in the Battle of Jarama. So I always wanted to write a play about the Jewish community in Dublin. And I came across the story of Etty Steinberg, who was a young girl from the South Circular Road who was murdered in Auschwitz in 1942. And when I came across that story, I was kind of paralysed for a moment by it, because it's not something that any of us really know or talk about. So I created this kind of passionate love story between these two characters, Ellie Rosen and Louis Doyle.
So the fictional part of this is that Ellie and Louis know each other, whereas the real life characters of Etty and Charlie never knew each other. Well, we don't know if they did at any rate.
Exactly. I mean, they would have walked the same streets and certainly inhabited the same city. But my characters, I went into their stories as much as I could find out about them. And then with all research, you know, as a playwright, you kind of leave it all behind and you go fly into a more mythical and dreamlike landscape to kind of explore the period and explore the chaos and the joy and the hardship of that time. And
you have them knowing each other, which is absolutely gorgeous, from school and knowing each other from, you know, very early days at school. And while there was hardly passionate love between 2 4-year-olds, but there was something from the minute they met each other right through school and up into their teenage years, that did grow, that immediate connection grew into a very strong love.
Absolutely. I mean, I think they were real soulmates, and they were two outsiders, because young Ellie is a Jewish girl in Dublin.
And we should stress, these are the fictional characters that we're talking about.
These are the fictional characters as well. But I did put them in the school that Etty Steinberg went to down on Donore Road, and the whole geography of it, the geography of Little Jerusalem and Harold's Cross and all of that. And obviously I've written a lot out of history in that period. Yeah. I've written out of 1960. War of Independence, Civil War. So my notion was that Louis's mother was involved in the movement. So he's a bit of an outsider in his Dublin of the 1930s, because he's still very kind of progressive and leftish at a time when Ireland was becoming deeply conservative. So he's an ardent communist. And Ellie is a young Jewish girl who wants to be Irish and wants to be a part of his world, but keeps getting kind of pulled back into that Jewishness and that little Jerusalem. So all the time, the two of them are kind of fighting a battle with society and expectation in order to be together.
And of course, part of the challenge for Ellie in this situation is the fact that she has fallen for a young Christian boy, a young Dubliner.
Absolutely.
And the expectation would be that she would marry and stay within her own community.
Absolutely. So in so once they get found out in the play...
Beautifully, I have to say. I don't want to spoil how, but it does involve a bundle of carrots in somebody's garden shed.
Exactly, it does.
And they're well into their, you know...
Into their romance and their ardour at that stage.
Their physical relationship is very strong.
Exactly, exactly. But once they get found out... Her family, in order to save her, marry her off to a cousin in Hamburg, not realising that they actually are sending her into the epicentre of the coming war.
Yeah.
And then Louis, in his devastation at the end of their relationship, goes off to fight in the Spanish Civil War. And so the play is also about war, and it's a cry from the heart against war, because it doesn't matter what side you're on or who you are, in the end of the day, we're all just hope and hurt and heart in the end. And I think it really goes into the complexity and the confusion of all of that.
Yeah,
but through a very joyous and beautiful and passionate relationship.
Because the phrase, why in the world is there always war, Ellie, comes up, and or why in the world is there always war, Charlie, even, you know, they are not Charlie, I beg your pardon, Louis.
Louis.
That phrase comes back time and time again in the script, that, you know, it's a question that's constantly asked. However, sitting behind us is one Mr. Steve Wickham, and the Spanish side of, I suppose we have those three locations, Steve. We have Spain, we have the German aspect of, and certainly the Jewish aspect of the music in here. So you have quite a broad spectrum of music to choose from and musical colours to choose from to create these locations and situations for us. How did the collaboration with Deirdre come up in the first place?
That's a very good question. Now, we've been talking about it for a while. Etty existed as a character in another piece of work that we had done a couple of years ago with Jerry Leonard, a great guitar player. And we worked on that. So she was very much alive as a character. And I think Deirdre's been talking about it for a good few years, maybe
10 or 12 years. Yeah.
And so that's how the collaboration took place. I kind of went in and did some research on the music of the Spanish Civil War. And I had a very interesting journey. I went up to Cavan in Anna McCarrick up there, and I met a beautiful Spanish poet called Javier Chiepo, who's a Galician poet from Vigo, one of Spain's great poets. And he was translating some poems. Among them was this poem. I told him I was working on this music for the Spanish Civil War. And he said, oh, I have a poem. And we worked on it together and turned it into a song, which is in the play.
And that's what you're going to
perform. And I would like to play it for you now.
And I would love to listen to it now. So off you go.
On a night of ancient terror, on a night that swells cold fists, six young men raise rifles to their shoulders, and they execute my order like this. You will kill your own dear brother. You will kill your gentle neighbor. You will kill your trusted friend. You will kill who I order. Ah, brother, you will kill. Take careful aim for the center. Pull your trigger and be damned. Let this mess already, let our gun smoke fill the land. Trusted friend, you will kill who I order. Ah, brother, you will.
Steve Wickham there with one of the songs from the play Tempesta, Deirdre Kinahan's play, which has been performed as part of the Cork Midsummer Festival. Extraordinary power in those lyrics, Steve. And in fact, they could speak very much to our own civil war, very much to any war happening in the world right now.
Mm, for sure. Well, Tempest is a play about the war. Why? It was such a why are we in the 21st century? 21st century, we've done so much, we're still...
Still at it. And I guess it does speak to events in Ukraine, events in Gaza today. And in fact, this play had been done, Deirdre,
yes,
just around, was it just after the events of October 7th?
Yes, I wrote it last year after a visit to Spain, and we did it in Glassmass Theatre on Dawson Street, lovely little new writing house there, and with a view to expanding it and doing it again this year. But when we were all full of Ukraine and stories about Ukraine, and it felt, even though it's set in the 30s, it felt so relevant now. But of course, we opened early October. And the central character, Ellie, is a young Jewish girl played by Stephanie Dufresne, who's a member of the Jewish community here in Ireland. And then you have the dreadful incursion on October 7 when Hamas go in. And then you have the Israeli response, which just ballooned and ballooned as we played for 4 weeks in Dublin. And it just, it kind of made the hairs go up on the back of your neck, because it just feels like this constant storm raging around the world, where we kind of push ourselves and push people from one end of it to another. And you think, like, with all the lessons we have, like the Spanish Civil War was the precursor to the Second World War. We know what happened. We know our history. We know where fascism and hate leads to. And yet we seem to be marching that march all over again. Mm. So I think that really plays with the audience, and it certainly plays with all the artists and creatives involved. It just feels very alive.
Did you adjust? Were there any adjustments? Did you relook at any of the script, given, you know, how things have developed since that first run in October? The word Awalia, home comes up again and again in the
again
script
and
as well,
again.
Doesn't it?
Yeah. Now, I just think, Sean, I can write about nothing else at the moment except kind of refugees, exile, you know, that movement of peoples and our response to it. It's just in just about everything I write. And certainly Awalia and home was a big part of it last year. But when we were going at it again, we felt that this play feels almost like a warning, you know, and a cry from the heart to say that if we don't all kind of just walk in love and compassion and empathy, we're going to walk into this carnage all over again. So phrases like, why in the world is there always war? I did write them in and just turn the volume up slightly, but in a way that kind of floats in with the poetry of the story that was there. Mm. So that for an audience, because I think an important part about this production is it's very immersive. We're playing in the PAV, which is an old cinema in Cork, which is Art Deco. And the audience will be sitting around the action. Steve and the two actors are on stage. And the notion is that they're ghosts who are conjured up by the music, and they come back to tell their story. So the audience are kind of sitting in the middle of this storm of love and war and history and truth. And it reverberates in the present as well. So I think that's kind of a powerful, unexpected aspect of
it. I noticed that today when I was reading through the script and looking through the script. There are, most of the type is in black, and then every so often there are these phrases in red, not least of which is, why in the world is there war?
Yeah,
and Awalia, and other phrases and words like that. So they are the slight adjustments that
they've
made.
They are the slight adjustments. Yeah, yeah. And it's just, sometimes you can do that with a script. You can just turn up the volume. I mean, if you ever get to go back to a play, there's always things that you miss that are maybe just a little, they're there through your subconscious, you know, but you get a chance to kind of really amplify them.
And that experience for you, Steve, of being in on stage with the two actors, that immersive experience, It's a very different one, I would guess, the liveness and the live nature of that from a gig with the Waterboys or a straightforward, if there is such a thing,
well,
music
gig. I love the magic of that theatre because you've got an hour. It's the same length of time as a gig a lot of the time, 70 minutes. So we're inhabiting a silent space. And I was just talking to somebody earlier about the difference was like when you're in a band and you're playing, it's great. People are moving their bodies and they're shaking along. They're getting into the music and the music goes into the combined experience. I mean, we're just bringing people together. You don't know whether Johnny and Mary in the front row are meeting each other for the first time and fall in love and go off. And many people say that to me. Oh, we met at that gig and we met at that gig. But with theatre, there's a kind of a silence in the space. And I'm looking out at the audience and I see their bodies are there, but they're gone.
Explain now what you mean by they're gone.
Their head is in
they're inhabiting our. They're living through the actors on the stage. They're with us in a way,
physically present, but emotionally they're on stage. With
you. The bodies are there, but whereas with music, they're moved. We're all. Yeah. It's just a different experience, and I love the magic of that, or the, whatever the word. I'm sure people have written papers about what that is, but I don't know. But I love being in there.
Yeah, well,
the audience are such a huge part of the telling of the story because every, you know, the actors respond to the energy of the audience as they respond to what's in front of them.
All within the framework and the text and the setup of the production.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's magic.
Don't have to convince me of the magic of theatre, that's for sure. Might have given into it once or twice myself. Thanks so much to both of you for coming into us this evening, Steve Wickham and Deirdre Kinahan. Tempesta, the name of the play we've been speaking about. It opens at the Pav in Cork on June the 14th and runs then through until the 22nd, all part of the Cork Midsummer Festival. For further details and information on Tempesta and indeed everything happening at the festival, go to the website, which is corkmidsummer.com. Bright Eye Burn is Molly Aitken's second novel. It's set in Kilkenny and during the 13th and 14th century and is based on the true story of the first woman in Ireland to have been condemned as a witch, Alice Kettler. We learn about her life, but we learn about her life before she was condemned as a witch. And we also learn that a woman with power is a woman to be feared. Delighted to be joined by Molly on the line this evening. The story of Alice Kettler and her being condemned as a witch is one I have heard before, but you, I think, if I've read this novel correctly, Molly, want us really to look at who Molly was well before any of those events and maybe to rethink as part of those events. What did you want to tell us or want us to think about when it came to Alice Kettler?
Well, I actually first heard about her when I was really young at school, actually. A teacher mentioned her and she was painted as this very villainous kind of character. Your stereotypical sort of witch, I suppose, like something from the Brothers Grimm or even like a Disney portrayal. And I was like terrified by her. You know, there's reports of her kind of having relationships with demons and killing babies and very dark things. And then after that, I sort of forgot about her until during one of the lockdowns, I was reading an Irish Times article and I stumbled on her there again. And there was several kind of Irish witches mentioned in that article, but she really stood out to me as being very, very different to the others. Usually we get these women who are the scapegoats, they're quite poor, they're possibly like older, widowed, they don't have any support, and so they're easy targets. But she wasn't that at all. You know, she was incredibly influential in Kilkenny in her day, and she was incredibly rich as well, and you know, had all these people who could support her. And that fascinated me. And I think because she was such an early case, you know, within Ireland, we'd never had a case before. Also, the UK had never had anything like this. France, there was a kind of a few little things. But I think with her, the church maybe learned a lesson about who not to
not to
accuse of. And that just seemed like a lot of fun to explore. And so that's what I did.
Yeah, and you bring us right back to her early life, the early death of her mother, and I don't know how to describe her father. In fact, very successful man, very well connected, but a very difficult and conflicted man, I think, as well.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I pictured him, we don't know all that much about him apart from that he was a moneylender in Kilkenny and that he owned and ran an inn, and that he was from this Flemish family that had settled there in the 1200s. But I used him as a kind of figure of maybe the kind of suppression and the patriarchy that she was then dealing with for the rest of her life. So I used a kind of novelist's instinct in that, which, yeah, was fun.
And Alice in your novel is a very beautiful woman. And I hate the word prize, but she is considered as such. That is how the men of Kilkenny look at her.
Yes. I mean, I tried not to describe her physically too much. I mean, she is quite a vain character and it is written in her voice. And we have like these few glimpses where she sort of lets her hair out and shows it off and it's very red and big. But actually at that time, everyone would have covered their hair, women anyway. But I wanted more to kind of put forward that actually she was a catch because she was rich and possibly because she was so intelligent. She had all these connections that she could bring to the husbands that she eventually married. She had four of them, which I also found extremely intriguing.
Yeah. While you don't outright accuse her of doing anything to any of the husbands, you certainly don't say that she tried to stop their deaths. Should I put it that way?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that was the big thing that she was sort of accused of when the witchcraft case was brought to the Bishop of Kilkenny at that time, Richard Ledred. And it was basically her stepchildren who accused her, and they wanted to get her money, in my view. And I don't think they foresaw the consequences of accusing her and what that would then lead to. I mean, up until that point, you know, there hadn't been any cases like this, so they couldn't have predicted where it would go. They just wanted to get their inheritance, I believe. But yeah, I don't I don't overly go down one path, but you have to read it.
Yeah,
see.
Absolutely, to find out. Yeah. One of the first men that she marries, in fact, is William Outlaw, who was a great rival of her father's at the time. And not necessarily the man that she really loved. I think it was his younger brother that she really loved, wasn't it?
Yes. So, I mean, this is something that I kind of took, again, license as a novelist. But what I found very interesting about the case was that Roger really supported her and went to bat for her.
He being the younger brother, yeah.
He was the younger brother. And this is kind of, I suppose, the fun of writing about a time so long ago. I mean, it's 700 years now, exactly, in fact. And so anyway, I was questioning, like, why would he have stood up for her and really fought her case? You know, if she had been accused of killing his brother and all these other husbands as well. And so I took a bit of a punch that perhaps there was something more there.
And certainly the ardency, if that is the correct word, of the desire of many of the men who approach her is quite noticeable.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, she's a character who I really wanted to be very confident in her sexuality. I think I had a kind of, I suppose, like prim and quite buttoned up idea of what medieval Ireland was. And actually, within my research, I found it wasn't like that at all. And it was later on that we had maybe more kind of say, strict rules around sexuality. I mean, that's not to say that you could have sex outside of marriage. You absolutely couldn't. But it was a much freer world than I had imagined. And I just loved portraying that, because I think later in Ireland's history, we become very strict and very confined in our sexuality. So it was a joy, in fact, to write someone who was so open and kind of confident within that realm. When I hadn't read many women like that within Irish fiction.
Yeah, because just because it couldn't happen doesn't mean it didn't happen. That's for sure.
Exactly, exactly.
At one point along the way, she says, Alice declares, "I am Lilith." You might explain who Lilith was and how that feeds into the character you've drawn for us.
Oh, yes. So Lilith was Adam's first wife. And,
as in Adam and Eve.
Adam and Eve, the Adam, the original Adam. And she was like the wife that went wrong, I suppose. The one who was considered evil, but she was created like Adam, you know, by God as his equal. And then she was gotten rid of because she had her own ideas and Adam didn't like them. And then Eve is created from him. And so I liked that kind of comparison of Alice being, you know, that a woman who feels equal, if not better, to all the men in her life.
What about the Kilkenny that she lives in? What kind of place is that?
I mean, what's lovely actually about this, writing this book, was I could go back to Kilkenny and, for example, her inn is still standing. It's now a pub called Kittler's Inn, and you can go in and have your pint. I did a bit of writing there while a session was going on and kind of felt her presence in a way. There's like a huge statue at the front of the pub, actually, which is like of a witch and we're like with the broom and everything. And I really had this sense that actually that was not how she would want to be portrayed. I just had this sense that she was actually, you know, like we were saying, a very attractive and confident woman. So it's been lovely to kind of give another interpretation to her, I suppose. But the Kilkenny that she was in was, you know, very different to now. It was incredibly dangerous and, you know, there was civil war at the time often. So it was a very violent world in many ways. And really, I wanted to kind of look at how a person would act within that world. I think we're very judgmental of people's behaviour in the past, but when we put ourselves in their shoes, it's hard to tell if we would do any different.
One of the ways the book is, the form of the book is that the chapters are basically in chronological order for the most part, but in between these chronological sections, so you might have a section labelled January 1279 and one labelled January 1280, etc. In between those strong prose sections are what essentially look like quotes, you know, people saying things like, oh, she's off with the fella now. Oh, what happened to her father? You know, so they're, it's almost like gossip. To what extent do you think the record regarding Alice Kittler has been full of rumour and gossip rather than historical fact?
I think it's massively influenced by gossip. And actually, I wrote those sections to really give the reader a sense of that. In my writing of the character of Alice Kittler, I didn't feel like she was really listening to gossip. I don't think she really cared what people thought about her. But I needed a way to kind of show that there was this kind of rising animosity. From my research as well, I couldn't see any reason why she would have practiced witchcraft. I don't think that was useful to her. I mean, she was so wealthy through her money lending and through her marriages and her husband subsequently dying. I mean, that was a great way to make money. But yes, so everything that was said about her, I think was in order to blame her, really. And it wasn't true, from what I can tell. I mean,
is it going too far to say that you might even question the historical record as told to us by the Bishop Ledred?
Yes, as far as we can tell, he wrote it, and he gives a very compelling narrative, but it seems extremely extreme, like, and you almost get the sense reading it that he was then kind of supplying the information to the people who were accused. I should say Alice was not the only one who was accused. There was 10 other people. And within torture, they were told what to say. You really get that sense when you read the record. Yeah, and he was also very aware of the laws at that time. And so he could really kind of skew the case to make them seem guilty.
So it's a case of methinks the bishop doth protest too much, is what you're saying. Thanks for joining us this evening, Molly. That's Molly Aitken talking to us about her latest novel, Bright I Burn, which is published by Canongate. And so, final section of Friday evening's programme, in fact, as usual, is our album reviews. Three for you this week, all of a shared connection to Ireland: Eels, Bonnie Lighthouse Man and Landless. Each recorded significant portions of their latest works across various locations in this part of the world. Mark Oliver Everett, driving force behind Eels, brings us Eels Time, an album reflecting on life's fleeting moments, perhaps not quite as loudly as I just called it out, but it is in capital letters with an exclamation mark, partially recorded between California and Dublin was that album. Bonnie Lighthouse Man, the acclaimed folk supergroup, delve into the 70s sound with Keep Me On Your Mind, See You Free, half of its tracks recorded within the confines of Levi's Corner House in Ballydehob, West Cork. Mm-hmm. And Irish quartet Landless release Lurach, an album steeped in traditional harmonies and recorded at various locations around the country. Aoife Barry, Eamon Sweeney have been listening to all three albums. They're with me in studio now. We'll start with Eels and a track called Goldie. There's a goldfish swimming. Goldie, dedicated clearly to his goldfish, or to his non-existent goldfish as of yet, his desired goldfish. That is the third track on the album Eels Time from Eels. And as I said, Aoife Barry and Eamon Sweeney with me in studio this evening. He's had a bit of a rough time, it has to be said, poor Mark Everett, hasn't he?
Yeah, he has. I describe him in my notes as like a fragile everyman. You know, he's someone who has had a very interesting and tough life. I mean, his sister took her own life when she was about 39. His mother died of cancer when he was very young. His father had a heart attack at quite a young age after, you know, kind of living quite an unhealthy life for a while. But his father is also basically a genius who came up with quantum physics theory about there being basically a kind of parallel universes. It's called the Many Worlds theory.
Tell us more.
Well, do you know what? I will, but I don't think I did physics for my Leaving Cert. That's okay. So I would give you a terrible rendition. I don't even think Mark Oliver Everett, even himself,
yeah.
There's a great documentary on it though, Parallel Worlds, Parallel Lives, about the two of them, worth watching. But he's mined a lot of this for across his records. Electroshock Blues in 1998, I think, was where he talked a lot about losing his mom and losing his sister. Mm. But he's someone who, I always think of a guy who writes sad songs about like sad things, but in a slightly weary way, but he still has a nice bit of energy to him. Like he's still trucking along, even though life has thrown everything at him. And it really, really has.
Well, I suppose anybody who kind of feels that a goldfish will fix it all can't be in that bad a state. However, I was taken by, and maybe he got a little bit of a translation done for him when he was recording part of this album in Ireland. We won't see her like again.
Yeah.
I was kind of amazed at the colloquial nature of that.
Absolutely, such an Irish phrase.
Yeah.
And, you know, I do find that the guy is really interesting and he does really interesting lyrics, but I don't find
there's
the
boat coming.
I don't find the music that interesting. I find that very Beatles-y, ELO, but without the sparkle, without the joy. And look, and I get it, it's supposed to be bittersweet and everything. It just gets very plodding, I find. And the tone is almost identical throughout the record.
I have down here quite laid back throughout, I wrote down on my
page.
You know, and it kind of does keep that track, Goldie, that we just heard, kind of one of the more upbeat ones, it has to be said.
Yeah, that's very upbeat for that record. And I think the first two songs on the record, one of the first opening tracks, very short actually.
Time. I thought it was a Jim Croce song.
Yeah, it's quite kind of Beatles country.
Like that. Yeah,
it does. It's very kind of, you know, minimal, very a little bit dour. The first two songs didn't quite hit me. And then the album does pick up and gets a lot better. And I do feel like if you're an Eels fan and you're used to his sound and you really like that he's maybe not doing super big, loud, he's a few quite rocky songs, but that at the moment he's not doing this kind of wide sound, you will actually enjoy it because you enjoy him for what he does. But I did feel that overall it didn't wow me as much as perhaps I might have expected.
As you wanted it to.
Yeah.
Let's have a listen to the final track, which is called Let's Be Lucky.
Let's be lucky.
What a mess. I can only guess it's going to get worse. And that's the kind of the brighter side of the lyric on Let's Be Lucky. You're still kind of going pretty mediocre musically though, Eamon. You weren't that moved
there.
It's
got its moments like that, but like overall, the whole album just no.
Okay, the whole album just no. What does that mean, stars? They won't be putting that on the front of it. Stars?
2.5.
2.5 stars. Yeah. So the whole album, that just sounds like just meh.
Yeah.
Okay, and what are you saying?
I'd definitely be kinder to poor old E, as he's known. I really love that last song that you just played there. It's the final song of the album.
I liked it, too.
Yeah, I'd give it 3.5 overall for the record. I think if you're a fan, you'll find loads on it you'll really enjoy, but it might be a harder entry point maybe for brand new people.
Okay, 3.5. There's all your physics coming out, and you're now using decimal points and everything in your stars. Let us move on then to Bonnie Lighthouse Man, nominated Bonnie Lighthouse Man, double album called Keep Me On Your Mind, See You See You Free. Now, if you're going to do a double album, you'll want to be doing a good one.
God knows how I found my way past the hounds of the morning.
Horseman Tumbling Down from Bonnie Lighthouse's new album, Keep Me On Your Mind. See You First. Even the title is too long. There are 20 tracks, did we say, on the album?
There's 20, but there's 18 songs. So two tracks are kind of like interludes. And they feature Irish people talking, an Irish child, and Irish people at the venue where they recorded half
the album.
How
much money could we make in the royalties out of this or something?
Yeah. They're like, can't remember. They say something really funny and very Irish anyway. Think of the royalties, lads, I think.
That's what they're talking about. But it's a big ask now to ask you to stay for 20 minutes. First of all, who are we talking about when we talk about Bonnie Lighthouse
Man? So they're a trio. I find it interesting that they're called a supergroup, but I think you'd have to really know a lot about them individually to understand why they're a supergroup. But they're really, really talented musicians. Anais Mitchell, she has about 8 solo albums. Josh Kaufman, he's worked with The National, Josh Ritter, The Hold Steady, The War on Drugs. None of that's going to be a surprise if you just listen to that song he just played. Eric D. Johnson, he's the singer that you could hear there singing with Anais.
The vocal duties?
They share them.
All three of them sing.
I think all three of them sing, but you mainly, I think, of Eric and Anais singing. And basically Josh and Anais started jamming together, and then Eric came on board and started playing. And this is their third record. The first one was mostly traditional kind of folk songs, but not super folky, not as folky as as Landless, who we'll hear. And then the second album had more of their own compositions. And I think this is pretty much all their own original compositions. And they work so well together. I do feel like they feel really bedded in as a group of musicians who come together, because sometimes I feel like with the so-called supergroup you can feel like the kind of joins between the members. You don't feel that here. They're
how proud should Levi's Corner House and Ballet of Hob be? How much did it influence Aoife has already mentioned the track that we hear, the Irish people, I presume it's people in that pub. How proud should they be that some of it was recorded there?
I think that's kind of like a blessing and a curse in a way that it was recorded there, because I think it leads to this really long record that they kind of like didn't really edit down kind of properly. I do like the warmth of those kind of like in between bits a lot more than the music itself, which I find very much seems to stay in the same kind of lane. It's very kind of mainstream kind of country rather than an alternative country that I would kind of maybe gravitate towards. But for Bally de Hob, I suppose it puts it on the map that little bit more. But this Grammy-nominated...
Yeah, you're sounding like an Eels lyric there with your kind of lugubrious kind of... You're totally infected by Eels. Let's have a listen to another track on the album. This is Bonnie Lighthouseman again. When I Was Younger.
Now that I'm older, I'm
rocking a cradle, rocking a baby who's always crying.
Yeah, I kind of like that. I don't know, that's when I was younger, from the Bonnie Lighthouse Man, the new double album, Keep Me On Your Mind, See You Free. And if I didn't have such a long title, I wouldn't have to keep commenting on it, and we could talk more about the music itself. But she really, that's Anais Mitchell, yes. Yeah. She brings something really quirky, kind of voice, vocal quality.
Really quirky, almost like a slight squeak before she starts off singing. It's gorgeous. Her voice is stunning, and it really does add something huge, I think, to the record. And see, I'm a real sucker for anything that sounds like Laurel Canyon, you know, Van Morrison, Fleetwood Mac, you know, even if it's the mainstream end of it. Something about it to me is really nostalgic. I think growing up with a dad who's really into that music. So I think I liked it a lot more than Eamon, because even though I do agree there are too many songs on it, really, but they're all really good songs. I think that's the problem. They're really good at writing a certain type of song, and they're, you know, the lyrics are lovely, the, you know, instruments sound great. They're just really good at writing a song. So I'd imagine it was just really hard for them to cut down that record.
Okay.
But I think if you want more of the songs to stand out, if it had been a 10 song album and maybe not a double album, you wouldn't be so caught up with maybe thinking there's 20 songs here, because there's some really, really beautiful, beautiful moments on this record.
I find myself saying each of these individually is gorgeous, but, you know, I don't need another helping of those gorgeous potatoes that you made, or I don't need another helping of that gorgeous sweet that you gave me, you know.
Leave us waiting a bit, leave us yearning for the records. For
stars
the
from you on this one, Aoife.
Four.
Eamon?
2.5, I would say.
2.5. God, you're in wild good mood tonight, aren't you?
He's going rogue tonight. He's like, nobody's going to pass here.
Nobody's going to get me past 2.5.
Dead right.
Pass.
Dead right.
I think we're using that word kind of lovely and gorgeous. And kind of
It's not a gritty record, and I can see why for some people it's maybe too slick for them.
Too sweet.
And unfortunately, I really like
that.
Might
be another word.
Yeah. All right. Let us move on then to Landless and their new album. Their second album, it is, in fact, isn't it? Lurach. Love the harmonies here.
Oh, the promise you made, it is now that you break. I would prove thou so loyal and true. Were there ever a poor, misfortunate boy, as easily led as you?
Stop press. Eamon Sweeney positively smiled. Well, there was a slight crack across his face, I thought. Aoife, did you, as we were watching there?
Observed a smile.
I think that Landless and Lurach may have excited you a little bit more than our previous two albums, Eamon.
So. How could it not, when you hear those harmonies? Like, you know, in recent years, this kind of, you know, Irish folk and traditional renaissance, for want of a better word, which I really think was always there. Artists, I think, really just expressing it in a much more kind of cohesive and confident way. And we have great voices like Rady Pete from Lancome and Lisa O'Neill and so on. But to have this ensemble of great voices, I just think is astonishing. It reminds me of the early Clannad, where they'd sing a cappella, but more minimal and gothic and mysterious. And, you know, it's not just traditional Irish, there's Scandinavian influences here and Slovakian songs and all this stuff. Yeah. And it's brilliant. Brilliant.
Quartet obviously. Of great voices. Who have we got?
So there's four singers on it. They've been together since 2013. Lily Power, Maeve Mayer, Ruth Clinton and Sinead Lynch. And I think anybody who's seen them live, I've seen them once, I think, will just, you know how incredible it is to hear them singing together. And I think they very wisely pulled back on the reverb that they had on their first record, so it feels really pure. You just feel like you're in the room with them. John Spud Murphy, who's worked at Lancome, great producer, really has brought a lot of darkness to this record.
Yeah. Because I did notice it at one point, because I'm not sure, I can't remember from the first record now if it was totally a cappella the whole right the way through it. Yeah. But on this album, occasionally that the kind of the Lancome-like drone, not quite as dark as the Lancome drone, but a kind of a little bit of texture comes in underneath the vocals.
Absolutely.
And it eases its way in a way. Rady Pete, she was in the room with me the week before last, talking about how Spud Murphy has kind of... He's a master at this kind of work. He really mixes in underneath some of the music beautifully. Here,
oh, absolutely. I mean. And you know, Cormac McDermott from Lancome is also on this kind of like in a very, and he was just a musical genius, I think, and up there with the Martin Hayes or the Con McInimers of this world in terms of contemporary modern traditional Irish music. That's just extraordinary and not shackled to any particular, you know, the tradition is the starting point as opposed to being something that kind of is, confines the musician.
Yeah.
And I think it really is an astonishing record. Another modern Irish classic that I think to be celebrated.
Well, now we're getting somewhere. Maybe it's just because we're near the end of the programme that he's happy. I don't know. Let's have a listen to, you mentioned Slovakian, and this is a Slovakian song, I do believe, Ej Husári. There's an example of what we were talking about, Aoife, where there is that kind of drone-like sound underneath it, and it builds from the drone to the single voice into the voices there, and it builds and builds throughout the 5 minutes and 15 seconds of Ej Husári. In fact, the correct way to say the title of that track from Landless. You enjoyed this album, Aoife, as much as Eamon?
Yeah, I did. I definitely think for some people their mileage might vary in terms of listening to this all in one go, and it's very situational, I think. I think popping it on the old phone and listening to it while you're part of the house, not really the best place to be listening to the record. It is very much in you to be in a certain moment and a certain vibe. Yeah. But I'd give it 4 stars out of 5.
A 4. And what are you saying, Eamon?
I'll go further, 4.5. I think it's a remarkable achievement. And I think it's worth noting that, as well as the Slovakian and Scandinavian influences, Irish traveller called Paddy Doran taught them a song.
All
as
right.
Well.
So, a solid 4.5 there for Landless from Eamon, 4 from Aoife. And before that, we were speaking about Bonnie Light, Horseman, and Eels. Aoife Barry and Eamon Sweeney are two reviewers on this Friday evening. Who was the Corkonian who won the Best Actor Oscar? Well, if you wondered, where have you been hiding? Have you been under a stone for the last while? Cillian Murphy, of course, was the gentleman in question. And Ellen Ellen Roach from Rathfilly in County Carlow is our competition winner this evening, going to see Jenny Green and co next Friday live at the Marquee, and the Owl Overnight Stay for 2 at the Metropole Hotel. Have a great time, Ellen, on this night week. But that is our lot for this first week of June here on Arena. Barbara Rose Sanwell was the researcher, Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator, Mark Dwyer was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme was produced by Reg Luby. Talk to you once again Monday, 7 o'clock here on RTE Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.